Welcome to the Aquariumax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 60, recorded May 2nd, 2011.
All right, welcome everyone.
Hello, happy sort of May Day. Yesterday was May Day.
Yes, we had another foray into the world of microphone technology, and we're still working on that. We've got another microphone setup that we're going to try eventually, but the testing has been sort of not very effective yet. So we're still running on our old equipment, but if the new equipment, we're able to get it to work, then we'll move to that soon. So stay tuned, and if it sounds really bad on the new stuff, let us know. Or sounds a lot better, whatever, let us know.
Yep. Okay, first up today we have an email from Dave D. that we are going to address, and he had a few questions.
Indeed. So let us go to those questions that he had here, shall we?
And the first is about water changes. He had some kind of specific questions about how water changes work using a Python.
Right. And a Python, for those of you who may not know, is simply a water-changing device that hooks up to a faucet, and basically by channeling water from your faucet through a very small channel, it creates a kind of suction in the gravel washer that's attached to this long tube, and then sucking the water down into your sink from your tank by using some of that water.
So you don't have to put it in a bucket and then dump the bucket out and then fill up the bucket again and dump the bucket out and then fill up the bucket and try to pour it into the tank.
You're right. And we've had one for many years, and we would not be without one. With the number of tanks we have. So, but these are very good questions that Dave has. He mentions that he realizes that it's important to condition the water because you need to remove things like chlorine and chloramines and heavy metals and so on. And he's wondering how that works with a Python. Since
it comes directly from the sink.
Right, comes directly from the sink. So how do you get it to have the water conditioned? And how does it come out in the right temperature? Another issue that Dave has particularly is that he has one tap that does not give soft water, which is the cold water in the kitchen.
All the rest of his taps give off softened water.
Softened water. So that could be an issue too, because you do modify the water parameters, obviously, by using soft water, as Dave mentions. So, and generally, soft water is not considered to be, well, let us say that soft water that has been softened by a commercial household water softener is not water that is particularly good for fish necessarily. And there are different types of water softening, of course. The most common is water that is softened by exchanging calcium and magnesium ions with sodium ones from salt, and so you're adding sodium ions to the water. So that's often not a very good thing for your fish. So that could be a big problem. And then Dave also mentions that people using a Python must add the new water directly to the tank from the Python and then add the conditioner, which exposes the fish to the chlorine for a time. If that is the case, is it a problem? Well,
that's what he wants to know.
That's the first thing that he wants to know. I would say that, well, we use a Python. We do water changes directly. We drain the water, and then we fill the water directly from the tap. We use a water conditioner that we add at the time. I usually try to make it so that it lands in the stream of the water that's getting into the tank. I'm sure that this exposes the fish to a small amount of potential toxins in the water, such as chloramines and so on. But my experience and understanding is that with the volume of water changes I'm doing, which I do try to control for temperature we don't have a water softener, so we don't have that particular wrinkle to throw into the mix, but the water changes have not been an issue in general. Sensing the temperature of water with my hands as I mix it before I put it into the tank, I put my hand in the sink and feel the temperature of the water to see what the temperature is and try to get it fairly close to the tank water, and it's never really been a problem for the fish. I've never noticed any a negative effects from it. I have noticed positive effects. You know, water, fish usually feel a little energized by water changes. I noticed that. There is one exception. Right after we moved here several years ago, I was filling up the tanks, and I miscalculated somewhere, and so I lost some cardinal tetras. Either there were too many toxins in the water, or it could have been some gas bubble issues or something like that, but I lost some cardinal tetras. All the other fish were fine, but cardinal tetras a little more sensitive than some others, and I lost most of those from that. I was trying to do my best, but we were moving a lot of tanks at the same time, and it was sort of a race against time, and so I messed up somewhere, and that has happened. But other than that, I've never had an issue with that, at least not within recent memory. So the short answer is, yeah, I don't think it's a problem in most cases, even with the goldfish where I change, you know, about 40% of the water in at a given water change. I just add a little more conditioner, and they never seem to worry about it. And in fact, with the goldfish, I often don't add warm water to the mix that goes into the tank. It's often quite cool, but of course, with goldfish, that's generally not a difficulty. I think, though it's important to think of temperatures and you don't want to shock fish, I think in a lot of cases, healthy fish can take more of a temperature shock than, you know, fish that are stressed right out of the store. So if you have healthy, well-established fish, they can take a little bit more of a temperature change in many cases. So,
for his situation with the water softener, since he can't adjust for temperature,
mm-hmm.
would you say using a python for him would still be worth it? Would we have to know what kind of fish he has to really decide that?
Well, that would probably be a consideration, yes. And I do know some of the fish he has from the pictures, which, incidentally, go check him out on the resource pages. He has some pictures of his fish room that he sent us. Well, I'll put those up on the resources page. So he has some angelfish, and it looks like some African cichlids and some other things going on there. But I'll have to look again at the pictures, because I have just started looking at them a little while ago, so to go back and look. But I know he has angelfish for sure. Anyway, he's got something to help him solve this problem. He's got a 55-gallon plastic drum. He notes that it was used to ship a juice product, so as long as you rinse it out carefully and safely, as I'm sure he did, that's a pretty safe way to go. If it's food grade and it didn't have, you know, detergent or oil or something in it, then it's pretty safe. And it's not used, you don't use soap to wash it, obviously. He puts cold, unsoftened water in it, adds conditioner, and then he has a 200-watt heater in that drum that brings it up to the proper temperature. And he has an airstone running in it, so you can avoid, you know, outgassing. That helps it outgas in the drum instead of in the aquarium, which is good. And then he has a pump and a hose that reaches all of his tanks, so he just pumps it in. His question is whether this is overkill or not. And he knows that we have...
So it does sound like a lot of work.
Sounds like a lot of work. And he says, you have a lot of tanks. What procedure do you use? Well, I guess I sort of already answered that. I just use the Python straight. And it hasn't been a problem, and I have...
If you had the water softener and the temperature issue that he has, what would you do?
Okay. With the water softener, I think I'd probably do something similar to what he does, honestly, because I don't want to put that soft, salty, you know, soft water in my tank. It's not super salty. You can still drink it, but you're replacing a bit of calcium and magnesium with the sodium. It's not really balanced water for most fish. So, yeah, I would probably do what he does. That sounds like the safe way to do it, and in his situation, I think I'd go for that. He also mentions about the temperature and how closely does the temperature need to match the tank. If the tank changes 2 or 3 degrees for a short period of time after water change, would that be a concern? 2 or 3 degrees in most cases, no, unless you have really sensitive fish. Or maybe fry, you know, young fry, something like that. If you had fish like maybe betas, young betas are kind of sensitive to great air temperature differences between, you know, the air and the water, and they can, and as their labyrinth, their breathing, accessory breathing organ is developing, that could be a problem. I don't know about just the water change, but that just comes to mind. I would be careful with fry and really sensitive fish, but 2 or 3 degrees in most cases, I don't think it's a problem. And it hasn't been a problem for me. Let's see. It says that he's got 8 tanks in the pictures, plus a tank in his kitchen and one upstairs, and so he's doing a partial water change pretty much every night. Wow. So you're always running the heater, and 25% water change with the new water 10 degrees below the tank temperature would lower it by about 2.5 degrees. Now, I haven't noticed that being a problem, like I said, with the setups that we have. Now, he also has another question.
About test kits?
Yeah.
Says, I test my nitrates with an API liquid test kit. The instructions say to hold the test tube against the white part of the color chart card. And he wants to know, in our opinion, does this mean touching the card with the part of the water, the container holding the water, or just holding it up in front of the card? Because when he touches it to the actual card, it looks a lot darker and is harder to judge. It's got shadows on it. And if he moves it away, it looks a lot lighter, which would indicate a lower nitrate level. And he wants to make sure that he's doing it right, so obviously he can get the right reading. Right. So, what do you think? What do you do when you do a test kit?
That's a really good question, and I've been thinking about that. And this is the conclusion I've come to. That okay. I think what they mean is holding it up against the card. But I kind of want to call...
Against the card, like touching it?
Touching the card. But I think I should probably call, or somebody should probably call, Aquarian Pharmaceuticals. That's the company, I believe, API. I think that's what that is. Because they... that would be important to know, because it does make a big difference in how you view it. I've always taken it to mean that it's up against the card.
Like actually touching the card?
Actually touching the card, yes.
Okay.
But I don't really know, so... We'll see if we can call them, and then we'll get back to you on that. Let's see what their response was, because that would be interesting to find out. Dave also mentioned here that he was wondering about cutting the amounts of water and reagent in half.
Essentially and getting double the number of tests.
Double the number of tests per kit.
Yeah.
I'd never thought of that. It sounds like an economical thing to do. But I don't know.
I imagine if the proportions were the same, it would still work.
Logically, it does make sense. Maybe we can ask about
we
that, too.
We can ask them.
Call
them.
I don't know. I've never thought of it, but that's a good idea.
I don't
know
if they'll want to tell us that or not, because then we won't have to buy as many kits.
That's true. One way to do it would be to, you'd replicate the tests and keep doing it over and over again at different nitrate levels. So you'd prepare some water with different levels of nitrates in them, and then test them with half the kit and test them with the whole kit.
See if
they consistently come out the same. And just replicate that several times, and then you could get a reasonable idea of the accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That would be one way to do it.
There's somebody's science fair project for next year.
There you go. Okay, now we had another question back here that we sort of skipped over because we wanted to get two other questions that were more close related. So, let's see. Here we are. Okay, well, Dave also mentioned that he has some pictures of setup included, but we already talked about that. We're going to put those up on the
resources page.
And he said, I also think it would be interesting to have some pictures of how your tanks are set up. We have seen videos of particular things in the tanks, but not how they are situated. For example, do you have a separate fish room? Okay.
Fish room, we used to have a fish room, not just a fish room, it was a pet room.
Yeah, with quite a few aquaria in it.
And assorted other critters.
Yes, leopard geckos and...
Sugar gliders and anoles.
And rats and different things.
Yes. And even my sewing machine tucked away in the corner.
Yeah, so it was a pet / sewing room.
Yes. When we moved out of that house, after that was when we went to Hawaii, and because of the laws, we weren't allowed to take anything with us, so we were kind of starting over from scratch, and we were in a much smaller place. And since then, and even after we've moved back to the mainland and have more space again, well... It looks like the break is coming up, so you'll have to find out after the break what happens when we have more space.
The exciting conclusion after this.
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it? Okay, so, moved back to the mainland and we have more space again. We decided not to do the fish room thing because we wanted the tanks to be more integrated in the house as more of the decor rather than you only see the fish when you're in the fish room. You know, we wanted to be able to sit on our couch in the living room and watch our goldfish or, you know.
Right.
Watch the frog swimming from the dinner table, that kind of thing. Have it be more a part of the house rather than separate.
Right. And we still, even at that time when we had the room with the pet room, we had like a 55-gallon tank down in the living room. And we had a couple, one or two tanks in our bedroom and so on. But it just, we found out that the fish that we enjoyed the most were the ones that we could see the most as we were going about our daily activities and so on. When we were in Hawaii, we noticed that we had a 29-gallon tank with a couple of goldfish just fairly near the kitchen table. Of course, everything in that apartment was near the kitchen table in the entire building.
Everything was near everything else because it was very small.
Small, but the nice thing was that as we're eating dinner, we'd see the goldfish swimming along and we'd say, oh, look, Captain Jack looks like he wants a pea. Or Calico Jack.
His cucumber.
Name was Calico Jack wants a bit of a cucumber or something like that. And so we'd go over and feed them and the kids would comment on it and everybody liked it. And it was more fun. And so we've tried to, you know, integrate them a little bit more. And we have some tanks that are tucked a bit more out of the way than others. We have this 55 downstairs in our family room, which is also our exercise room and our computer room and so on. So we interact with that one fairly often. But we've tried to do that a little bit more. And, you know, it's not the solution for everybody, but that's what's turned out to work for us. So that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. And I could see, you know, if you have a lot of tanks set up that aren't display tanks, there's breeding tanks, or, you know, you're breeding various critters in the water to feed to your fish, they're not display tanks. And if you had a space in the house where you could just stick them on a shelf and they're just, you know, utilitarian, functional, and that's it, then that would be a good way to store them, really, and keep them, because they're not display tanks. But for the display tanks, we would rather have them integrated into the house.
Yeah, which reminds me, right now we have that Daphnia tank that's in the living room under Hito's tank, their frog. And it looks really ugly because it's got algae growing in it. But
because it's
that's
just
what I
to grow
it
Daphnia.
Just to grow Daphnia. But
yeah, it needs another place to live.
Yeah, we need to move that. But there you go. There's some ideas on that. One thing that I... We're going to try to put some more videos up, and a lot of that is just time issue.
It's been a little crazy lately.
Yeah, we haven't been able to put up as many videos as we originally planned on. We've been meaning to do a video on breeding grindleworms for a long time and
so
haven't gotten
around
to it. So
we will work on that soon. Unfortunately, I spent almost all of April being sick.
So that didn't work out too well as far as that
went. But now I'm starting to feel like a normal human being again, so we should be able to get a little bit more done.
Yeah. And there's another issue, too, is that I have a 55-gallon aquarium here. It's featured in the rainbow fish videos, with rainbow fish eating grindleworms and rainbow fish courtship. And part of the issue is the tank is old. It's really old. I mean, I got it third hand at least. And the second hand was my cousin, and he had it for years, like more than 10 years, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's an old tank. And I am very grateful for it, but, you know, in its long lifespan, it's gotten quite a few dings and scratches in it. So if I were to take a picture of the whole tank, it just wouldn't be the most aesthetically pleasing thing in the whole world. And I'm not sure I want to put that up, because it's scratched. It works for us in here, because it's just down in the family room, and we enjoy looking at the fish. And
it's like your comfortable battered couch.
Yeah, and we're breeding bristle noses and rainbow fish in it and stuff, and growing Java moss and Anubias. It works for us, but it's not going to win any prizes in the aquascaping contest. nor is the tank itself in the greatest of shape. So,
but if you guys would like some more pictures of some of our other tanks, we can work on getting some pictures of the whole tank rather than just the species in it and putting those up on the resources page.
Yeah, it might be a while, but we can eventually get there.
We'll get there.
Yeah, I still want to set up
and we'll get some more videos up.
That, what is it, a riparium for Hiro the Frog. I still want to do that. We got to do that.
We should just make that a whole video project.
Yeah, we'll make it a video
for you guys.
That'd be cool. We'll see if we can get to some of that. So thank you for bringing that up. Mm-hmm.
And for sending so many good questions. I think those were good,
questions,
good things to think about.
Good on you, Dave. Thank you for doing that. And this is not to be confused with Dave, the feather duster guru. It's a
different Dave.
Yes, but just to make sure that's clear and nobody's wondering about that.
So, Dave, I guess the bottom line is you can keep doing what you're doing with the water softening
issue. I would in your case, yeah. And we'll see what we can do about contacting API and see what they say. Of course, they might not be the end-all answer because, you know, they're trying to make money, too. I can't blame them for that. But my idea about doing the different tests at the different amounts of water might be one way to address that. Mm-hmm. It would waste a lot of your kit, I guess, but there you
go. But it might save you some money in the long run.
Yeah, it might, if you're willing to sacrifice one kit for the good of many. So... we had a couple of other fishy news things.
Oh, yes. One was kind of funny.
Yes.
We had a little spoiled brat Placostomus moment.
Yes. You probably know that we breed bristlenose placos, which we kind of do whether we want to or not. We've got all kinds of little babies appearing all the time. So I always have plenty of them. You know, I'll bring them into the pet store once in a while and get some credit for them, but you got to grow them up to a reasonable size usually before they like them or before they'll give you anything for them, really. And anyway, I've always got a surplus. There are plenty of them around. So I thought, I set up this tank for some really teeny Daphnia or some sort of Cladoceran like a Daphnia. I'm not sure if it's what species it is. It was sold to me as Moina, but I've had something else that was given to me as Moina that was probably 4 or 5 times that size. They're teeny. They're bigger than a newly hatched brine shrimp, but only about maybe 3 or 4
not
times the mass of that. They're not very big. They're very, very small. Anyway, they're great for the celestial pearl danios. So I have this little tank for culturing them, and the culture is going great, but the sides have algae all over them, and it's really not very aesthetically pleasing. And I thought, why don't I put a baby bristlenose placo in there? So I did, and he or she, I don't know yet, began working on it and growing like mad, actually.
He was in there with all that algae all by himself.
Yeah, without competitors. So, that was going well. But then I thought, well, it would be nice to produce some infusoria in that tank just to make it easier to feed the little creatures and make it more of an ecosystem. So if I put some mystery snails or something in there, they will eat, you know, I can throw in green beans and zucchini and stuff for them, and they'll produce infusoria for the little Daphnia to eat, which is not my idea. Other people have done it, and it works fairly well. And I've grown green water that way and things like that. So I thought, oh, that would be a good idea. So the other day I was at the pet store looking around to see if they had any mystery snails, and they didn't really have, they had some really expensive ones that I didn't want to get. They were like golden sunburst mystery snails or something for $5 a pop, and I thought, well, let's see what else they have. So they had some Spixy snails, which are closely related to mystery snails, I guess. Well, I'm not going to say very closely related, actually. I don't think they're all that closely related to mystery snails, but they're an aquarium snail. They look fairly similar. They're kind of attractively striped. And
plus,
one thing,
it sounds like pixie.
Yeah, it kind of does. I believe that's the species name. It's like Azoline or Azulene or something. Spixy. And anyway, these snails were 49 cents each. And I thought, well, I've read a bit
reasonable
about Spixy snails. And if I get too many extras, no problem. I have enough assassin snails to choke a horse that will make short work of any extras that I get. And interestingly enough, unlike mystery snails, which breed by laying their eggs above the waterline, and then the egg masses eventually soften and kind of dribble into the water, the baby snails, Spixy snails lay their eggs underwater. And they're actually related to the Colombian ramshorns, those really big ones. Mm-hmm. I had one of those years ago. They're interesting. But anyway, put some in, and this little bristlenose placo became what would be termed in, you know, a human, if we saw something like that, we'd call him angry.
He was having a tantrum.
Yeah, acting territorial. He would go up to these snails and whip them with his tail, try to push them out of the way.
He'd been an only placostomus for too long, and now he didn't know how to share.
He was the absolute sovereign of all he surveyed, and suddenly he's being inundated by spixy snails. So it was interesting to watch him attempt to assert his territorial supremacy or whatever
you
want to call
it. He went on for several minutes. He was having a fit and tail beating and looking quite upset about the whole thing.
Yeah, so we moved him into a different tank, and now he's happy with some of his siblings, and at least we hope he is. He's not beating up on the snails anymore. But it was just interesting to watch that behavior. And it's interesting to have spixy snails. We'll see how that goes.
And we can get some pictures of those.
Yeah. So far they've been eating green beans and peas and all sorts of things and algae. And that's exciting. So one last thing I'd like to mention. At work, we've been raising some
Triops,
among other creatures. Some brine shrimp, some triops, some... What else have we been raising? Fairy shrimp and Daphnia and so on. Anyway, some of my students are raising... they're all doing experiments with these different creatures about, you know, how quickly they reproduce, what type of salinity the brine shrimp prefer for, you know, maximum reproduction, different kinds of experiments. How aeration affects Daphnia is one of them. The ones who are doing the tadpole shrimp, they are studying the effects of light and temperature on hatching success. So they're setting up the experiment. You know, the idea is that they're learning how to apply the scientific method and so on correctly in the situation. And so they've been controlling for, their independent variables, the ones they're trying to figure out what's going on, is the light and the temperature and hatching rates.
Of the triops.
And the interesting thing that we found, they'll put one identical container of triops with the same number of eggs, as far as we can control that. We're doing it with eggs in sand, because I have these huge quantities of sand full of triops eggs. So they're putting the same amount of sand in, and some detritus, and so on, and then distilled water. And they put one of them under a heat lamp, as you usually do to hatch triops, because triops, you know, generally are thought of as requiring... sufficient heat, sufficient light, and then water with very low dissolved mineral content to be able to hatch. And then the rest of the survival and all that is a whole other kettle of fish, but those are the three main requirements that everybody talks about and generally thinks about when raising triops. Okay. Then they take another container with a black plastic bag over it, so it's getting very, very little light. In a dark corner of the room, with this black, opaque trash bag over it, so it was really getting very, very little light. And the first time, they had an experiment that wasn't totally a surprise. I mean, the outcome. The container under the black trash bag, we had two hatch, which I was surprised that even two would hatch, with almost no light getting to them. And then the other container had about five that hatched. And... then the next time they did it, we got almost opposite results. In the container in the dark, seven of them hatched. In the container with the light, only two.
And that was the surprising part.
I had been under the impression that hatching triops really did require substantial amounts of light. But apparently it doesn't require as much as I thought. And I don't know really how many eggs are in the sand. I mean, they're... who
probably
knows how
many.
Probably
more than two.
But we are controlling for the sand quantity and... so on, and we'd probably need to replicate it many more times to get a really decent, you know, scientifically rigorous result, and also we'd have to be a lot more careful. Probably have to actually count out the number of eggs going into each container and so on, and we're not doing that. But the upshot is just that if you put them in the complete, not complete darkness, I suppose, but really close to complete darkness, then they're still hatching. The room is warm.
Amazing.
The room is in the high 70s. So the temperature and the water are the correct conditions, but the light is not the ones that you typically think of as being able to hatch triops, and it's still working. So that's really interesting.
They're tough little guys.
They are. Once, years ago, I had one of those Triops kits. The ancestors are the ones that I continue to hatch. They came in with some detritus with some fairy shrimp eggs and some Daphnia eggs. And one day I decided to hatch some Daphnia only from them, so I put a container in a very cold place where the temperature, you know, was probably in the 60s, probably low 60s, because I wanted to hatch the Daphnia, and I didn't want to hatch any Triops just then. And this is what happened. Daphnia hatched, but in about 4 days, some Triops showed up, and I didn't recognize them immediately as Triops because I didn't expect them to hatch.
They ate all the Daphnia?
No, they didn't, actually. I removed them to a different container and raised them separately, but the idea was it was way too cold for Triops to hatch, and they did anyway. So I may have gotten a higher yield of Triops had I provided the right conditions, but it was interesting to see.
The idea is that it's not impossible.
Yeah, it's not impossible to raise Triops under less than ideal conditions, apparently. Because
which would make
that's
sense.
That's what we've seen. So very interesting.
For survival in the wild.
By the way, those of you who haven't heard it, we do have a Triops episode way back when. So
it was a long time ago.
You can do a search and look up Aquarimax and Triops, and you can find out all more about them if you're interested in doing it.
Okay, well, I think that's everything for tonight.
It is. That's a wrap for this week.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.